David.
Hi, how's it going, Ed?
Introduce yourself to the audience.
Okay, my name is David Klink. I'm a poet. When it comes to fiction sides of things, I love young adult novels. I love your novels. I've read The Bloodhound and Terrier, and for some reason I didn't bring them today to get you to sign them, but they are fantastic. I've also read every one of my brother-in-law's books. So Robert J. Sawyer is my brother-in-law. He's married to my sister, Carolyn. So I get to read them in draft form. So I can proudly say I haven't read one of his books in final form yet. But so that gives me a sense of what, you know, what goes into sort of a good writing and stuff like that. But that's mainly it. I've got two collections of book-length poetry. The most recent, Monster, came out in November, which has dark, strange, surreal, and unusual poetry.
I'm going to forgo this. Hope people can hear me. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City, where I teach courses in fantasy fiction and creative writing, among others. My first novel came out almost 2 years ago now, called The Third Sign. My next two are on submission as we speak. I'm also co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics, involving such notables as Ed Greenwood, wherever he... Oh, Ed! involving people like him. And I also... co-host a show called Speculate, which is a podcast that interviews and talks about the work of various speculative fiction authors like Kid Johnson and James Patrick Kelly and Elliot de Bedard and Pat Rothfuss most recently and N.K. Jemisin and people like that. And you can find that at SpeculateSF.com.
Okay. I'm going to use this because I know I speak softly. I am Gabrielle. The snake doesn't
reach. You broke it.
I broke the snake. I'm too much for it.
There's a clamp.
For the snake.
That's going to hold it for me. Thank you.
I always do.
I'm Gabrielle Harbowie. I'm an editor, writer, and small press publisher. I'm a freelance editor for Pyre Books and Seven Realms, and I'm the editor in charge and associate publisher of Dragon Moon Press. And also a writer of short fiction. And my latest project is the collaboration When the Hero Comes Home, co-edited with Ed Greenwood.
Ed Greenwood. I have published 138 books, both gaming and...
Great.
Yeah.
I know.
And lots of them have heroes in them, and lots of them have wannabe heroes in them. Some of those wannabe heroes make it about three pages before their journey ends forever. And that's why I'm on this panel.
Yeah. Scruffy was interested. I'm Tamara Pierce, Tammy. I write adventure, fiction, fantasy for teenagers. I specialize in girl heroes, but that doesn't mean I scorn the guys. They, too, get to kick plenty of butt, you know, along with the girls. But the girls come first so far. The next three books are all guy heroes. So that ought to shut up those who keep asking. Briar is in it with Rose Thorne and Evie, so he's flanked by girls. But the two new mare books are new mares.
My fellow librarians will just freak. Oh, boy protagonists?
I know.
Where do we put them?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I know exactly where they're
going. Oh, it's going to be one of those panels. All right.
And the librarian.
I guess started back the other way with my idea of what makes a hero. Obviously, it's not sex. Well, not whether they're male or female or other.
You're doing it wrong.
I've been doing it right. To me, a hero is not necessarily someone who is naturally brave. There are such persons. But
that's an idiot.
I'm of the school that if you aren't scared in bad situations, there's something wrong with you. You've got some few switches off, perhaps, but fear is a really good thing to have. And the difference between a hero and an ordinary person is that a hero proceeds to try and rectify the situation despite being afraid. And those situations aren't just battlefield situations. They're social situations. They're situations where you're not sure that what you're doing is the right thing, but you see someone else in trouble, and your instinct is to help as best you can. To me, that's what a hero is. And you don't always know who has it in them. Jill Peyton Walsh, The Emperor's Charm, I think it's called, did a book where a young boy was really unhappy about following the last Byzantine around as the city was under attack, because the emperor was always interested in food and whether pieces of buildings were damaged, while this one general was bright and glorious and brave and cheered the troops and made everybody happier when he passed. And then he got wounded. And all of a sudden he was screaming, he demanded to be taken down from the walls, even though his troops needed him for orders, and in the night he fled the city, because actually getting wounded, like Captain Hammer, was more than he could cope with. But the emperor continued to walk around the walls and talk to the men and make sure they were fed, make sure they had arms, and the boy came to realize there are different kinds of courage, and some are more necessary than others.
And I would amplify that. One of the things that we found when, oh yes, I'll do the shameless plug. When doing this anthology, I see Tony's here. Stand up, Tony. Anybody else here? Anybody else here who's writing for this anthology? Okay, one of the things you'll find if you read this, the stories are not like 19 fantasy stories where Conan clones pull out swords and you know,
wander back up to the castle gates and, yeah.
Yeah, they are complete gamut. Not just of genres, but of the size and shapes and genders and species of heroes. Everything's different. There's all sorts of heroism, as you were saying. And they're in real life and in literature, standing up for your own principles and making the right moral choice, even if it's just resistance. You know, I usually cite Patrick Stewart as Uriens in the movie Excalibur. You know, you're going to be ruled by a motherless boy? I saw what I saw. The boy drew the sword. You know, then they're all going to besiege him and attack him. But never mind. He knows that. He knows that when he says it. But it's like, no. The rest of you may be like, you know, moral twisters, but I stand for something. You know, and that's heroism as much as the guy who says, oh, there's a dragon in that cave? All these corpses and burnt scorch things? Okay, I'm going in.
You know? Yes. God help me, I'm going in.
Yeah. And if he says, oh, dragon, no problem, jumps off his horse, runs in, that's not a hero.
Singe.
That's not a hero. It's the man who says, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And goes in anyway.
Yeah.
It's the one that stands for something. And it's the one who'll do whatever they have to do, no matter how afraid they are of it, because they stand for something and because there's something greater at stake than just themselves. Stepping up anyway, despite being afraid, and doing what needs to be done because you know nobody else is going to do it.
And there may not be any reward or any glory, and there may not be even anybody else who knows, but you have to do it for your own sake.
Yeah, I think one of the things that distinguishes heroes from villains, and I actually think we have a little bit of a reclamation project to do, because I think heroes are out of vogue. I think villains have become increasingly popular.
No.
I'm going to disagree. I think they are, because I teach students who are constantly disinterested in heroes and very interested in villains. I think the difference is that one of the things that people find sort of troubling about the hero is that they find the hero uninteresting, and that's because they're reading, frankly, characters that haven't been done properly, heroes that haven't been done properly. I think the difference between heroes and villains is that heroes don't allow themselves to be dominated by the flaws they have. They have just as many flaws as villains do, but villains allow their flaws to consume them or overwhelm them or are unable to allow them to exist but do the right thing anyway. Right?
Or revel in them,
whereas, you know, heroes themselves can kind of work beyond that. If you look at the difference between a character like, let's say, play Beowulf and Grendel, right? And I teach in my fantasy course, I lead off with Beowulf and then follow that up with John Gardner's brilliant book, Grendel. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes... Now, Grendel is a fascinating character, especially as Gardner writes him. But I think the real thing that keeps Grendel from being a hero, ultimately, is that Grendel is dominated by his doubts, his insecurities, his uncertainties, his flaws. His story is fascinating, but he's not heroic. He can't be. He can't allow those things in him. He can't push those things down enough to do what is ultimately the right thing. And in some cases, he figures out what probably is the right thing, sometimes does it and sometimes doesn't, depending on whether his flaws have overwhelmed him on that day. Heroes, on the other hand, will not always, but usually do the right thing despite what their flaws, the little voice in the back of their head, is telling them to do. And so I think the more that we can make our heroes complex and yet distinguish them from villains because heroes ultimately do the right thing, even if it's a doomed thing to do, I think that's one of the ways to distinguish between those groups.
Grendel's had a little accident. So may you
so
all.
So may you all, yeah.
I disagree with you on your view of... I think your view is influenced by the fact that you teach college students.
Yeah, this isn't my view. This is, I think,
no,
their view.
No, but college students think that villains are deep.
Right.
And the level I work at, for the bulk of my audience, they want heroes. They need them. The villains are fun. But that idea that you can achieve something and it can be powerful, that has tremendous appeal in the middle grade and teen audiences. And adults, if you look at the bulk of the fantasy and science fiction out there, adults often come back to that idea that there has to be something better. There has to be something that we can follow. There has to be something that tells us that hopelessness is wrong. But so college students, though...
But I would agree that college students are at the age where the female ones will have the strongest, feel the strongest allure for the bad boy. Not at other stages in their life.
Just going to move over here.
Or Ed is hoping. That. Ed is hoping for that.
Yes.
The bad guys are supposed to be able to fix that.
No.
I think a lot of women go for the bad guy because they want to fix the bad guy. They think you're going to turn
it's
good.
It's so chuckle-headed.
So, I mean, yeah. I'm not saying they're right.
Yeah. No. I noticed you weren't. But. Yeah, the bad guy is alluring, but the bad guy is also not a good provider, not to be depended upon. They look wonderful when you're a college student, and I speak from my own personal knowledge. But if you explore the idea at all, you start to see the flaws. Mm-hmm. Most girls, young women, actually men, also go for bad boys. Unfortunately, too many of them in their leadership, and they don't stop to think it through.
Yes, he has all the toys and seems to be enjoying them.
Yeah,
the hero isn't enjoying them.
I was thinking when you were talking about the hero walking and charging into the dragon's lair and getting killed, I was thinking of maybe they should call that "I singe the body electric." But sorry, that was bad. At some point, I do the occasional pun, but one thing, the reason why I wanted to join the panel was I remember back to grade 13, because I actually wrote a little response to an assignment that was about the hero of romance, and it was sort of a short little piece, and I had to respond, everyone had to sort of say, well, what is the hero of romance? So at some point, maybe just a bit further in the panel, I'll just read it. It only takes about a minute or two to read, but actually detail some of the points of what makes the hero of romance, at least in this story, which some of it does apply, but I think in each story, the hero is a bit different and things may not quite apply the same way.
Al seems like a good opportunity to
read. Okay, I'll try it. So anyways, I will seize the opportunity and then I'll just enjoy the panel. But anyways, there is a story called The Handsomest Drowned Man in the World. And I had to read that, and this is what I came up with. The hero of romance is superhuman, and or he has a vision of the world that is larger, more expansive, more perfect than others. He is often a young man because he needs to... a drive to make the world better. He may be old, like an example of one of the characters in the story, but he retains youthful quality. He embodies all the noble virtues of human civilization. He displays qualities that link him closely to the natural world. He may be physically strong like the character in the story. He lives close to nature and understands the ways of Earth. He has virtue of courtesy, endurance, and self-control. A lot of these examples may not apply to other stories. He has highly civilized virtues of intelligence and imaginative powers. Above all else, he has vision. He is often attached to something bigger. Beyond our understanding, he comes from mysterious, unlikely, magical origins. He may converse with a strange world. We're almost finished here. Of intelligences or powers, like an example of a character in this story. It is from his contact with the world above and beyond that he ultimately seems to derive his powers over life. He is first and foremost a leader at the frontiers of experience, whose actions bring good to his people. Even in death, a heroic figure retains the power to raise the life of a whole village. And that was an example in the story. In the hero of romance, the ideals of the human race have come to be focused.
But what you've just read not only shows us the incredible variety in what was in there, but also what wasn't mentioned, who are also heroes. If you look at, just to pick a recent movie, Space Cowboys or whatever, there's the whole idea of a hero who is not youthful. It's the old guys showing the way. Going back to the morals of their childhood. Oh, their kids don't know what they're doing, so somebody's got to do it. And you know, they may in the end sacrifice their lives. They may go through privations to do so. But that's another form of heroism. And we've all seen it. Independence Day. You know, the crazy old coot who was right about the flying saucers. And what does he do? Sacrifices himself.
So that's the example it says in here, is that even if he's old, he still shows some youthful quality. Like, he will actually get out there and do something
and
show them.
And fly his plane
Well,
there's one big hole here, and I'm not placing blame because you're working off something you did about a particular story.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about the female hero. Mm-hmm. And she tends to be a very different kettle of fish. Joan of Arc, dressed up in mail, rode at the head of an army on a prancing horse with no sword. I used to think that, I was really disappointed when I found out she didn't actually fight anybody, but I've gotten older now, and I watched one of the Joan of Arc movies, not The Messenger, that one was crazy. The one with Lee Sobieski. Mm-hmm. And it suddenly occurred to me what a bigger set it takes to ride at the head of an army, under the flag, in shining armor, with no weapon of your own. A big, fat, drooling target. Knowing you're a big, fat, drooling target, than it might take to go up there with weaponry. With other female heroes, Barbara Hambly Starhawk is a nun, and she sees Sunwolf talking to the Mother Abbess about provisions, and she decides right there to put down her gardening implements and follow this man to war, and out of it. Elizabeth Moon's Pax Anarion. She doesn't want to go out and do good and be the avatar of the god. She wants to go and be a soldier and make some money and live her own life and see something of the world. I've been thinking a while about the hero's journey because everybody's been blathering about the hero's journey, George Lucas. And the women's hero's journey, as I see it, is there is no comet in the sky pointing out the arrival of a hero and great events. There is no cunning man to smuggle her away and place her with teachers who will give her the knowledge she needs to become a great person. There is no great series of trials. she must undergo to prove her worthiness. She gets up in the morning, makes her bed, goes downstairs, fixes breakfast, feeds whoever's living there, does the dishes, goes out, takes the laundry, hangs it up on the line. Round about 1 or 2, she takes off her apron, dusts her hands, and goes down the road to see what's next. It's very mundane. It's not super inspiring. No. No, it wasn't that good. And yet she goes and does it anyway. Why? Well, because it's there and nobody else is taking care of it.
I think that speaks to a larger point where heroes and leaders are not the same thing. And you don't have to be a leader to be a hero. You just have to be the person who steps up into what needs to be done.
A hero is very different. I hate citing my own work, but I had Raoul and Squire sit down with Kel and say, okay, Alana is wonderful. If you are in a dark place, you want Alana there because she will come in and she will conquer. That's a hero. They go alone. And then there are the men who will do what they're told in a fight if they're given orders, and those are soldiers. And there are men who are good at commanding other troops, and those are regular knights. And then there are the commanders, and they're few and far between, and they're needed badly. I think you can be a commander, and so we're going to start work to make you into more of a one than you've already shown you have an aptitude for being. Heroes are wonderful, but the guy who sits down, the guy or the woman who sits down at the desk with a pile of boring papers in front of them and works their way through, we need those even more than we need heroes.
Probably the best heroes may be aware of that dimly, that they don't need just them. Sometimes they need to come to have that awareness that it's not just about them and that they will have to rely on people who don't do the heroic things. But I think the commonality of what you read and what we've been talking about is, and I would argue even the person who does what doesn't seem inspiring is inspiring in their own way because of what it is that they ultimately accomplish, regardless of how they get there.
Well, ask anyone who's ever had a good teacher.
Yeah, I mean, inspiration is really critical, and I think that's one thing that what we haven't talked about here yet is about the anti-hero. What I find ironic about the anti-hero character, which a lot of people, I don't like the typical hero, but I really like the one that has all of this, again, depth, you know, and the Mad Max characters. And the odd thing is that the anti-heroes ultimately become heroes anyway, right? In spite of themselves, against their own best judgment, because they don't want to. You know, Mad Max is not, you know, the most pleasant individual, but he does drive the damn tanker. I mean, he does actually do something which is incredibly dangerous and probably will lead to his death, as he thinks at the time, and does it regardless because there is some core of him that still believes this is the right thing to do. Yes. And the anti-hero, I think, then, is just as driven by, one, the need to do right, ultimately, whatever they define right as being, and then, two, the need to inspire in some way. And that's also what he's doing when he drives that tanker. He's inspiring the other people to take a shot, too, when they have already given up on it. I think all of these examples involve inspiration of some kind or another, and ultimately the best hero, anti or not, is going to speak to that, I think.
Yeah. I can, you know, the movies that spoke for our generation, Star Wars, I'm just kidding. You do have what is almost like the anti-hero in the guy that's the Millennium Falcon guy, Han Solo. And there he is. And he takes his money, he's done his little bit, and he's leaving. Well, what happens? He shows up at... Well, I don't want a spoiler alert. Just kidding. But he does show up at the end, and he does that thing. Now, that what he does at the end there is a heroic act, because he didn't have to do it, and he could have left with his money. He's already done, actually, a number of heroic acts up to that. But that final decision that says, you know what? I have to pick a side. I have to do what is right.
And there's the key. It's the moral decision.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Long before that movie was made, there were innumerable American war movies, and they usually, many of them had a curmudgeon character, and who would be getting away with the loot at the end, and then he would say, oh, damn, or whatever, and turn around in the tank or whatever, and in the end, sacrifice himself, usually, because somebody had to do it. But the moral choice has to be there. If you just brainlessly ride into hacking and slashing and don't think about it, there's no heroism.
The Clint Eastwood character in some of those movies, he's right between it down, and he's playing both against just to help himself. But he does make a choice at the end that he says, no, I have to do what's right. I have to, you know, be on the right side and help the woman who has been, you know, held aside and say, free her and let her go off with her husband, you know, that kind of thing. He does that.
I think what we're saying here in a nutshell is that the hero has already made that moral choice and the anti-hero makes it on the page.
Hmm. Yeah, could be.
Max actually didn't do it because it had to be done. He did it to get vengeance for his dog and to cut collops off of Humongous because it was Humongous's people that messed him up in the first place.
I'm not sure I totally agree with you on that. Sort of.
There's the documentary evidence.
Well, agree to disagree. I think it's more than that. But I was struck by one of the people that I think does this best, actually, is Brandon Sanderson. And I'm thinking about Mistborn, where he introduces a character, Kelsier, who is absolutely a hero in every sort of concept that we would use. And yet Kelsier really isn't the point of that book. The point of that book is Vin, this young, you know, female thief from the streets who sort of learns to some degree from Kelsier. Kelsier does stuff which is definitionally inspirational. He does stuff literally to inspire other people to do something else. And yet, although he is the hero of that story, he's not the point of the story. The point of the story ultimately is Vin and what she's going to decide based upon what he's inspired her to do. And I think that's an interesting thing, too, when you can almost misdirect a little bit in terms of what ultimately is going to be the focus of your story. And it doesn't always have to be just the hero. It can be something else entirely, and the hero is just sort of a means to an end.
Well, I think the hero also, I mean, we shouldn't do these kinds of things, but I just wanted to mention again with Becca Cooper is the idea of someone who is special, someone who says, you know what, this person's getting away, but I'm going to chase that person through hell and high water and spend this amount of time and find and get that person, bring them back, and everyone will say, wow, you know, this isn't something that people do. You know, they don't go that far. And to take that just the extra level means that that's a heroic act itself. Like one of the, and a hero isn't just one heroic act. It's one after another.
That's why she's named as she does, Terrier.
Yes.
Because she gets her teeth into something and she won't let go.
Exactly,
she's hillbilly pigheadedness at its purest. She remembers what it was like to be grovelingly poor. And the fact that these people are preying upon that population, that could be her in that gutter, that drives her. Bloodhound is because you can't shake her off the scent. Mastiff is when she brings down the really big game. But to me, she's just like people, my family. I'm a hillbilly. And they get onto something and they do not let go. And it doesn't matter what it is. And Becca is just that same way. She gets a scent and she goes after it.
I think you're touching on something else that we haven't mentioned yet that is an integral part of the hero. We've talked about it in terms of making moral decisions. Many, many heroes have a moral code. And we may not know the moral code. They may be assembling it or building it as we read the narrative.
Yeah.
But they are deciding what is right and what is wrong. Yeah. And then they, in the end, they do what they think is the right thing. It may be stupid, it may be foolish. And I'm going to have to give the example, I would have to spoiler the book. Has anybody here read Inferno by Niven and Purnell? Okay. A science fiction writer dies and, of course, goes to hell. As all science fiction writers do. And they discover there's a particular person in hell before them, Benito Mussolini, who is their guide down deeper and deeper into hell.
Whatever happened to Virgil? Did he retire?
Oh, no, he's there too.
But
a particular character makes a moral choice at the end of that book, which is going to condemn him to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years in hell. Because that character thinks he's doing the right thing to repay the person who has already spent thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years in hell. Because you've done your time, buddy. Somebody else gets to take this role now. And that comes up again and again. If a particular god is not there to guard the bridge to the land of the gods in Norse mythology, somebody else has to take that role. If you smite that person down, or that person, or that deity, that entity falls, someone else must take their place. And that's also heroism.
Is that heroism, or is that martyrdom?
Well, yeah, but there's...
there's a thin line.
There's a thin line.
The line is really thin.
Yeah, and the what we would probably all agree is the safe side of the line is the Hobbit who says at the Council of Rivendell, "I do not know the way, but I will go." We would probably all agree that that's the right side of the line. But it is in effect the same thing. You know, they are disabled. Somebody has to take up this burden. All of you are sitting here quiet. All you big knights and wizards and stuff. I don't know the way, but I'll do it.
And yet, to me, Sam is more heroic because Sam only goes because he's been told to look after Master Frodo, and he, by God, is going to do it, whether Frodo wants him to or not. He's not taking on any.
Actually, that's a very interesting. You should mention that, because The Lord of the Rings gives us all of the heroes.
Yeah.
It gives us Aragorn. You know, here's my destiny. I have to reforge the sword that was broken. I have to do this. We have Gandalf. Hey, look, I've been doing this for thousands of years. I've been moving all these chess pieces. I have also a duty put on me from on high to do this, and I'm going to do it. I have Frodo. Jeez, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm a complete bumbler, but I got to do it. You have Sam, and Sam is in many ways the real hero.
Yeah.
But they are. We get all of them.
Yeah.
We get Boromir, the
great knight of the realm, the one that everybody loves and thinks, you know, is a hero until he is tempted and falls.
And falls. Yeah. But until then, and then you get the dwarves.
Yeah.
You get the elves and the dwarves sparring throughout all of Tolkien's literature because their styles are different.
Yeah.
But in their own way, the dwarves are as much heroes as everything else because they know they're doomed. The whole race is doomed, and they know it. The elves can go oversee. You know,
the dwarves are here.
The dwarves are here. We are of the stone, and damn it, we're getting wiped out. And the Ents are the ultimate tragic people of all. Where are the Entwise?
They have girlfriends.
Yeah.
I mean, that just bites the big one.
But Tolkien laid out the whole buffet in front of us. Here's all of us.
Yep. The entire gamut.
Mm-hmm. What we were saying about building the moral code, just to go back for a second, again citing myself, there is a moment when Kel, protector of the small, she's new, she's much discriminated against, and she sees some older boys hazing younger ones by kicking them around, and she turns and walks away despite everything she's been taught. Because they're bigger, they're stronger, she's already in a shady relationship with the program. And she's sleepless for two nights, I think it is, because she loathes herself so much for having backed away. And she thinks it out and she thinks, well, if I go in against the bigger guys, I'm going to get the crap beat out of me. But if I don't intervene the next time I see hazing, I won't be able to sleep. I think I need sleep more. I cannot exist with myself and be comfortable with myself unless I follow what I believe, even if it means I'll get trashed. And she's under no illusions. The bigger boys have more training. She is going to get trashed. And she does it anyway. But it's a long, hard struggle for her because we all want to go through life without being bruised and having black eyes and having to tell the training master, "I'm sorry, sir, I fell down." Because there's that other code that you don't rat out the enemy. To me, that struggle with heroism is always interesting. Because, and especially at first, she doesn't see any benefits to it. No one comes to help her. She's doing it in the back hallways alone and getting the stuffing beat out of her.
But you touch on another thing. There's the, and we all write juvenilia, usually in high school when we're asked to, and we think afterwards, oh, was this crap.
Mm.
And I wrote a heavy-handed satirical story which had two characters in them that were known as the live coward and the dead hero.
Yeah.
And they had lots to say to each other. The dead hero didn't speak too much. No. But there is also a heroism in saying, oh, I desperately want to charge down that hill with my shouting my battle cry and fight to the death. But
and all
I
the Indians in the world ride right down on you.
Yeah, but who else is going to, because I'm the last guy left who knows the way to the next watering hole. So I have to sheath my sword, gather the people, turn away from what I desperately want to do and the heroic thing, and serve as a drudge if necessary, work as a slave, disguise myself, go for years. And Guy Cade played with this in Tagana with the people who did what they had to do to survive for years.
Yeah.
Now, it's a popular literary thing that you do that to take revenge or to avenge the fallen. You know, and somehow that becomes laudable and heroic. But, of course, from another yardstick, it isn't. You guys lied, you cheated, you stole, you wore disguises, you did everything to evade your responsibility because you were serving a, quote, higher cause. You know, because you're gonna do it in the end.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen thousands of examples of that in literature, anything from the Bible to current fantasy literature, where the young kid goes to avenge the old guy grabs his wrist and says, not yet, kid, wait till you're ready to take it.
Yeah. It's that divide again between what you want to do and what you must do. Even, I don't think it matters whether what you want to do is a heroic seeming thing.
And your family will starve at home.
Right.
Or you go feed your family and the heroic thing goes undone.
Right.
And one day I will find him, that six-finger man. And I will tell him,
my name is Sue. How do you do? Now you're going to die.
And then sort of doing the right thing on the large scale becomes often more important to the hero than doing the right thing on the small scale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you let your family starve because the village or the country needs you more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how we grow a lot of messed up kids, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is
and often in worlds where we don't build in therapy.
Yeah.
That's a universal thing way beyond our genre, way beyond people who read stuff that has heroes in it. Mandy Patinkin says, of all the stuff he's done over the years, you know, when he started, it was, oh my God, you were in Yentl? You know, sort of thing. But the thing that really works for
him, I wouldn't
own
up to that.
Well, yeah. But it's that he will walk through an airport, and somebody who doesn't know him but recognizes his face will say, my name is Inigo Montoya. No, because that was... people responded to that more than anything else that he's done in all these years of acting. Even though they may have seen him on Criminal Minds, far more recently than they saw it, but that's what they remember.
Well, and Criminal Minds doesn't have as many quotable lines.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. We should take questions.
Yes, and there's a gentleman there who has been...
Okay. Questions? To be ready. Go. I teach that episode actually in my fantasy course, and the interesting thing is right after he lets Edith Keeler die so that history can go back in the path that it was, McCoy in his typical overreacting emotional, did you know what you just did, Jim? You know, and everyone's just doing this. And Spock is the one who says, he knows, Doctor, which is really important because it demonstrates that he knew that he was making the decision when he made it. He was conscious of the choice.
Yeah,
and that, I think, is the important thing. Yeah. You may not be aware that the choice you make will have the ramifications that Kirk knows it will, But you have to know as the hero that you're making a choice that has an impact. And so that's, I think, the powerful thing about that is he is conscious of having made this decision. Another example from Ursula Le Guin in A Wizard of Earthsea. Ged goes and speaks to the Dragon of Pendor, who will give him the name of the shadow. He will give him the name, and that will be it. And he takes this moment, and it literally says, and he sighed and turned away because he knew that was not what he must do. And his job was to keep the dragon on the island and not let him fly to the place that Ged was supposed to protect. So he turns away from almost in feeling that he's giving up his whole life because he's turning away from what this dragon would have done for him and instead goes back to, this is what I must do. And again, you're conscious that he's making this decision. That awareness, I think, is key to make the hero make sense when
sure.
his decision's
made. An unwitting choice is not
right.
heroism.
Right.
Yeah, and in that case, I think saving the woman is not the moral choice. I think that's the personal choice.
Right.
And it's very often the conflict between the moral choice and the personal choice.
Well, it's a greater or lesser moral choice. We're all taught that to save one life is a moral thing.
Yes.
But to save an abstract like a planet from a future that may not come
yeah.
to pass, that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing. And the two moralities just enter into combat then. Mm-hmm. Do you do the greater thing and lose your love, or do you do the lesser moral thing, saving a human life? And I'd like to put in something I've been thinking about, not only saving Edith Keeler's life, but saving the sanity of the guy who hit her and the people around who are part of that who will be affected by that. Although nobody ever stops to think about the witnesses and the guy yeah. who drove the car and everything.
And what she was going to do was create a peace movement. That's the whole thing about
yes.
that episode. It wasn't like
yeah.
save her from killing
yes.
someone, save her from doing
about,
a peace movement.
She
you
wasn't
know?
About to create the brown shirts.
Right, right.
Exactly. She was guilty of bad timing, though, because she yeah. said her message, if it was 20 or 30 years later, would have worked.
Yeah.
Right at the wrong time.
But
yeah.
and you point out another key. The hero doesn't have to make the right choice, or the choice that you as the reader would have made,
right.
I think is right, to still be heroic.
Yeah.
You can screw up. You can make the wrong choice and still be a hero.
Yeah.
And you can try a desperate gambit that you know is a long shot and not bring it off. And that doesn't make your sacrifice or your attempt any less
yeah.
heroic.
Right. But Kirk may have also realized, just momentarily, they don't mention in the episode that probably some green animal woman would show up in the next episode, and he'd be able to move on.
No.
So,
no,
but they
really.
Didn't.
That's just,
no, I'm
know.
Just kidding. I'm just...
Whenever Kirk fell in love, he fell all the way, even if it was just for 45 minutes.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
That 45 minutes was...
Not every week. Just yeah. enough weeks that you start to go, okay.
So what else do?
Yeah.
Did that...
It's really internal motivation a lot more than result. It's, again, the moral choice. It's about the choice and the reasons behind it. I think, you know, saving the woman or saving the planet can both be heroic things, and it totally depends on why you make the choice that you make, not on what choice you make.
And you may not be aware, as I said, of ramifications beyond it. If you think of the end of the movie Glory, which is, of course, based on history, that doomed charge at the fort, right? Obviously, they're slaughtered. You know, the entire division is slaughtered. And yet, what makes that important in a story that we remember, it was enormously inspirational and actually created a sort of sea change in the way that we imagined, A, African-Americans serving in the armed forces, B, the way that you could actually have the belief that they were that there was no way because, you know, just because they were emancipated, they weren't equal, right? But the sense that they could sacrifice themselves in the same way as whites would sacrifice themselves was this revelation to 1860s America, North and South. And so from that point of view, that sacrifice had at the, you know, was a doomed, disastrous charge in the very short term. In the long term, it was incredibly effectual, and that was, you know, he didn't know when the leader goes forward to do that, when the hero leads his men over into his doomed mission, he doesn't know what the impact is going to be. He does it because he knows it's the right thing to do at the time, and as it turns out, the long-range impact is significant too. So, other? Okay. Sure.
So the person who we say is the bad guy, he could he, like, in a way, sometimes you'll see bad guys who are just evil for the sake of being evil. But there are other bad guys who are evil because they see, like, a righteousness in the cause of what they're doing. Couldn't we call them a hero also? Like, can they be a hero in that sense?
What is the result of their deeds? If they're, the result of their deeds is blood and destruction and the elimination, say, of a group despised, then it's not a good thing. People don't do evil because they like doing evil. They do it because they think it's for a good reason. And they will be heroes to some. I mean, look at Adolf Hitler. He was a hero to a nation and a short-term empire. But that doesn't make what he did any less evil. He just never thought of himself as evil. I'm not real big on villains who do evil because they do evil.
If they're forced to do it, for example, someone like Dexter, who's there's something wrong with him that actually it's an impulse, it's something that he has really almost no control over, but he's almost treated as a hero because he's actually pinpointing people that should be died.
He's got the control to keep from hunting prey species.
Yeah.
And the strength of will to maintain the programming that he was given by his foster dad.
Yeah.
So his struggle against his own proclivities is heroic.
Is the hero, yes.
Well, I think what you're talking about, though, is being kind of the hero in your own story. And sometimes that can occur. David Anthony Durham's Acacia is a little like this, where it's not very easy to claim that one group is the obvious sort of heroic group over another. And in a way, they all think that they're doing the right thing. But there, it's very obvious to the readers in general that you're dealing with deeply flawed people all the time in every group. So you never get this sense that, okay, I can get behind, oh God. You know, you never get that sense because you're always aware,
Sort of like current day politics?
So, yeah. So it depends on the story.
But evil definitely always has to have a motivation. Evil for evil's sake
a reasonable motivation.
Evil for evil's sake is a one-dimensional character. It's not a real character. Whether evil is being forced upon them or whether they think they're doing the right thing or whether they think that they're furthering their own glory, they've got to have a reason.
It is human nature to rationalize something. Yeah. So if your character is human, then it would be logical that the worst evildoer will have good reasons that he or she has come up with over the years.
Right.
Yeah, one of my favorite heroes, strangely enough, is Jack Bauer from the series 24. Mm. And there's someone who does some pretty extreme things to get to his end, but he also steps up and helps people, but he also hurts. You know, it's one of the more interesting characters, but I think he's a hero in most senses, I think.
He's a torturer.
Yes, that too, yes.
I know we've sort of discussed this a little bit, like, how would you draw the line between a hero and a vigilante?
Most people can't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Most people, if you were the people of San Francisco, the entitled and enfranchised people of San Francisco, then the vigilantes who never bothered you are your heroes because they're getting the riffraff off the street. But if you're poor or a member of the underclasses and all you did was be in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're struggling in the United States now because DNA is showing us that sometimes innocent people get executed, which a lot of us feel is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like vigilante justice. Not everybody is going to see it as a good thing. And if you're that wedded to law and order,
and I don't think that just because we haven't worked it out yet.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
I mean, it's one of those.
Yeah, questions. We will never work it out. That's why we're
right. I think it's very similar to that whole, again, sort of one man's terrorist and another man's freedom. How do I understand? Cuba's still a very big issue there.
Yes, exactly.
It's very.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Most parts of the world where there's still political conflict, there's some people that are in great support of certain dictatorships in developing countries that for them have produced much good and done, and then there's people that they oppress at the same time.
Yeah, the old shtick about, well, at least he keeps the trains running on time.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are people who do heroic things even though other people may not agree with their methods. They may think that those are the only methods available, and that makes it heroic in a way. So.
And the countervailing moral thing is, well, if we behave like that, we are becoming the enemy we are fighting. So.
And maybe that's the only way you can fight the enemy. Mm-hmm. Right?
And then that's why we write these stories. There is no right or wrong answer there. You're always dancing in that, which side of the line will you come down on this Thursday at this time? Because same person may come down on the other side of the line later on.
Right. It's about movement and evolution, too. You know, you can have a character like Jason Bourne, as an example, who clearly starts out as this assassin and is clearly not, you know, good, is doing villainous stuff, whether or not the United States government thinks he's doing the right thing is a whole other matter.
Yeah.
But clearly he's doing something which is, you know, in sort of objectively evil. The difference, what makes Bourne so interesting, is that Bourne clearly changes. He then is on a path of redemption where he wants to make up for what he has done, and he wants to try to use his talents for the good in that regard. And that, to me, is one of the most interesting kinds of heroes, because he's a hero who comes from a place of villainy and has made a decision himself to change something about him. Now, it also helps that everyone's out to get him, and so he's, you know, got to worry about that too. But there's also a decision that he's made where he puts himself in extremely dangerous situations because he feels the need to go back to trace his steps, to find the people. He goes back to find the daughter of these two people he killed so he can apologize to her, even though it's an incredibly dangerous thing for him to do. That demonstrates movement and sort of dynamism and evolution in the character, so that you feel you're dealing with not the two-dimensional prop like I am hero with sword, but you're dealing with a character that you would expect to see and know and object to the earlier part of their life, but respect what they have become. And that's different, too.
It's that anti-hero moral journey.
Yeah.
He finds
the hero's journey.
He finds things about
anti-hero's journey. Yeah.
He finds things about himself that he doesn't particularly care for, but when he realizes that, you know what, I actually did stand up for myself, even though I was reprehensible, because when I was on that boat and the two kids were there, I just could not finish my thing because I could not kill someone with their children right there.
Yeah.
And even though he was already in that mindset, and then later on he understands that.
And there's the moral gray area again, because that very thing that you're pointing out was the mafioso code. And we heard it very recently in the news when a guy got whacked in Montreal, and they put a microphone in front of a mobster. He says, you don't do that. You don't do it in his house. You don't do it in front of his wife and kids.
Or at church. There was this whole list of things.
Yeah,
exactly.
They had their own moral code. Does that make them good?
No.
Leave the gun, take the cannoli, and all that stuff. That's a code, too. But other question?
Very much so.
Because you compare the biblical heroes as opposed all the way up to the classical age of the comic and superhero to, I believe that the first season of Heroes and Lost was the first one.
I saw an interesting panel on this, and this is what I was getting to about the hero not being in vogue, maybe to be a little bit more specific about it. I saw a panel at Comic-Con in New York a couple of years ago where they were talking about the evolution of Captain America as a hero. And I'm not an expert in any way on Captain America or comics more generally, but the gist of what these people were saying, including one of the original writers for Captain America, is that Captain America over the years had become darker, more sort of morally gray, did not, you know, the sort of shield with the big sword. I mean, that was the sort of jingo patriotism hero at one point, right? And had become over time, almost literally you could see in the pictures of the comics, had become less clean. Whereas early on in the, you know, when it was initially created, it was always shining, like, you know, clean as could be, and because that was the image. Over time, even the shield became dirty. And how that reflected our own sort of shifting moral codes, our own opinions about ourselves. I have a sense that that's sort of a pendulum sort of thing, and it will swing back to the side where we do want our heroes bright and shiny again, and maybe what Tammy was saying about the young adult audience always needs this, the middle grade audience always needs this, maybe that's true, but it seems that in the short term, you know, there are these shifts back and forth. So, and I think we need to go, right? Thank you very much, everybody.